Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. March 5th marks a pivotal moment on the political calendar. It is Super Tuesday. And for the first time, California will hold its primary, along with 15 other states. This first big step in the 2024 election cycle serves as a litmus test for candidates, offering a glimpse into their appeal across California's diverse landscape. On the national stage, California does carry weight, influencing the trajectory of campaigns and setting the tone for the rest of the electoral season. However, there is concern that voter apathy and low enthusiasm for these candidates may shape turnout this year. We have two guests to get us ready and pumped up for the primary, which is 2 months from today. Kim Alexander is the president of the California Voter Foundation, and Mindy Romero is the founder and director of the Center for Inclusive Democracy, which focuses on voter engagement and voting patterns. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, Kim, I want to start with you. Why was California's primary moved up to March 5th? Remind us why this happened.
We've had primaries in March in the past. Our last presidential primary was March 3rd, 2020, right before the pandemic. So we kind of got in under the wire with that one. But we moved it up because we wanted California to have a bigger voice in deciding who the president would be. We were finding having the primary in June resulted in most of the decisions already being made by voters in other states and candidates dropping out of the race and voters, you know, having voted for candidates who are no longer considered viable. And that even can still happen in March. So it's no guarantee that it's going to be easier for voters. We did also have a bifurcated primary 1 year where we had the presidential primary in February and then the other elections in June. And that was just terrible. It was expensive in terms of having multiple primaries for counties to pay that cost. And then the voter turnout was really bad. So I think it's good that the downside is, you know, we toggle back and forth. We have presidential primaries in March, non-presidential primaries in June. And the disadvantage of having it in March, which people are feeling now, is, you know, the time that you need to get ready for the election hits right around the holidays. And so it's difficult for election staff, it's difficult for campaigns, and it's difficult for voters.
What are the biggest changes that you want voters to know, given that it's getting moved up?
Well, the biggest change with this election is this is the first presidential primary in California where all registered voters are going to receive a ballot in the mail automatically. And that's a benefit for voters to have that convenience of being able to vote that ballot from the convenience of their own home and not having to go to a voting site. But the downside is that this is a really tricky primary, Vicky. We have partially ajar primary process for presidential primaries. And for voters, what that means is, you know, we have this top two system where in all other primary elections for Congress, for the U.S. Senate, for the legislature, all partisan elections, voters can vote for any candidate of any party. But when it comes to the presidential contest, the one voters care and hear the most about, that rule changes. And the parties have closed their primaries to voters who aren't members of that party. And so some parties like the Democratic Party allow nonpartisan voters to cross over and vote for their candidates if they choose to do so. But the voter has to get the right ballot. And that's where it gets difficult when you mail them all out in advance to make sure that voters are getting their preferred ballot. So there have been a couple changes that have been made recently. There was a bill enacted last year authored by Assembly Member Gail Pellerin, who's chair of the Assembly Elections Committee. AB 292 now requires a voter's ballot who's a nonpartisan voter, no party preference voter, to actually disclose on the ballot itself that that voter has the right to cast a partisan ballot if they choose to do so. So I think that will help a little bit. But I expect there's going to be a lot of ballot shuffling going on. People, you know, voters are notoriously dallying and getting their ballot materials open. They'll wait to the last minute and then they're like, oh my gosh, I don't see any of the candidates I want to vote for on this ballot. So the biggest message to get across is pay attention to what you get in the mail, open your election materials early, get the right ballot that you want to get ahead of time so you can vote for the candidate you want to vote for. And if you want to vote in the Republican primary, you need to re-register to vote. That's something that a lot of people don't understand. So it's not hard to do. There's plenty of time to re-register, but you know, I was looking over what I got in the mail over the holidays that I let sit on my mail pile and saw that I got my crossover ballot notice from Sacramento County because I'm no party preference. And I was supposed to get this in by January 7th and I did not. So I'm already behind in this process.
If it happened to you, it could happen to any voter, Kim.
Yeah. And this is the problem when you have it in March is that, you know, people really aren't paying attention during the holidays to what's going on.
Yeah. And I have been in that boat of waiting until the last minute and it is not fun. It takes a lot of time to kind of like cram everything in there. I guess what advice do you have for just kind of like manageable things we can do, you know, in the mix of all the busyness of life to kind of get us prepared for the primary that hopefully will result in a healthy, a robust turnout?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, one thing to remember is that you have options. You know, if you get a ballot in the mail that isn't the ballot you want to vote, you can go to a voting site and request the ballot that you want. You don't have to use that ballot. So the most important resource for any voter is their county election office. They are staffed by people who are ready to help you. And so if you get stuck and you need help, just call your county election office and ask them to help you. And yeah, make sure you open your materials early. You can also check your voter registration status. That's a really good thing people can do right now. I actually checked mine just before we came on air to make sure mine was up to date and make sure the process all worked because it's been a little while since we've used this tool. But that's on the Secretary of State's website. And you can get to it from our website at calvoter.org. It's right up there in the voter tools section. So check your registration status. Make sure you're registered at your current address. That's a really important thing. You know, for people who are housing unstable, they might want to just plan to vote in person and not worry about that vote by mail ballot and just plan to go to a vote center. You can register to vote at a vote center on the spot. You don't have to be pre-registered.
Finally, I mean, you and I, before I move over to Mindy, and please stay on with us after that, you and I have talked about this in the past, you know, when it comes to election offices and, you know, how stressful and trying it's been in recent years. I mean, obviously we have social media, there's misinformation, there's disinformation. How do you want people to navigate this? Because that likely can pick up this year. It's a big election year.
Yeah, it's unfortunately, you know, we have not seen the big lie go away. There's still a lot of people who make claims about elections that are not true, that are not based on facts. And so, you know, the important thing is to get the facts, to not believe everything that you hear, to go to trusted sources. Again, your elections office is really the primary source. The Secretary of State, Shirley Weber and her staff do a great job getting information out on their website and out to voters. So, you know, go to those sources and also, you know, have fun. I mean, one of my slogans for this election year is to make voting fun again. It has been a really difficult time for everybody involved in elections the last couple of years. And, you know, I want people to remember what this is all about. We're exercising our rights. We have freedom of speech. We get to wear our I voted stickers. I mean, there are a lot of really joyful aspects to the voting process that I want to remind people of, because that's what makes it worth it to go to the effort to cast that ballot and make sure that it gets counted. So, you know, bring the fun back into voting and encourage other people to vote and help someone out if you can. It's not, you know, some people like to say voting's easy, and I'm always reminding people it's not. It's hard. There's a lot of procedures you need to follow. There are a lot of complicated measures on the ballot and choices to make. And so if you can help somebody out with that process, that is really a benefit too.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and I want to bring in Mindy Romero, the founder and director of the Center for Inclusive Democracy. And Mindy's research really focuses on political behavior and voting patterns. Mindy, you and I have talked many, many a times. I mean, voter turnout in California and the United States is not good, and it hasn't been historically. But for this election year, you know, what concerns you? What's kind of bubbling up to the top?
Sure. Good morning again. You know, I really want to start off by just echoing what Kim said. I really appreciate her wanting to focus on the positive. And I think we really do need to, wherever we can, because it has been a difficult few election cycles, right? And a lot of Americans are, if they are following our political landscape, you know, they're concerned, they're sometimes confused, and the stakes are always high when it comes to our democracy. And of course, now as well, very much so. So Wherever we can, we want to focus on that. But the reality is, when we're looking at a primary, this is a very important primary, right? It's a presidential primary. We do often in media conversations and at home, people are focused in on the presidential race. Of course, we want to emphasize that there's a complete ballot, and there are very important state and local races that affect people's everyday lives in many ways. They're even more consequential, right, for everyday folks, for your listeners. I'm concerned about low turnout. We know we are always going to have low turnout in a primary, and that turnout is going to be not representative of the population of eligible voters. So in any given election, as you know, we've talked about this, in California, across the United States, the population of those that actually cast a ballot, even in a high turnout election, is older, it's more affluent, it's more likely to be white, homeowner. It doesn't represent the population, and that has consequences, right, in terms of just the strength of our democracy and the outcomes, right, and the policies and so forth. But in a primary, it's really low. So in our last primary, 2020, which was a good election year in terms of turnout, only 37% of eligible voters, adult citizens in our state, actually turned out to vote. So we had an overwhelming majority that didn't participate in that primary. That's likely to happen again. We hope not, but just historically, we always see that in March. And that means that you have a very small subset that is very not representative of the population that's going to be making choices for that general election ballot, right, where we will see more people participating. And so just understanding that the ballot that many people do pay attention to when it comes to the general election is chosen by that smaller group. We want to make sure that young people are represented. We want to make sure that voters of color are represented. We want to make sure renters are represented, right? And of course, that 37% is much lower when we talk about voters of color, 22 and 23% for Asian Americans and Latinos. 16% of eligible young people age 18 to 24 turned out in the 2020 March primary. So I think beyond turnout, of course, I'm concerned about misinformation, disinformation. The primary process can be confusing, period, as Kim just outlined really well. And I think in this day and age, in this era right now, we're facing even more confusion around just the information. People are generally information low when it comes to participating. And now it seems to be even harder, right? Many people not trusting the sources, not having the resources they need to kind of sift through what is correct, what isn't. And as we head into 2024, we know that the misinformation that's going to be out there, generated a lot by AI and other sources, is just probably going to make things even more confusing and unfortunately may be the story of the 2024 election season, aside from those who actually, of course, win races. We're just really concerned. So we want to be positive. We want people to be armed with information. We want people to be aware of what they need to do. But at the same time, calling it out in terms of the importance and the seriousness of that disinformation, misinformation that people may be coming across, so they know, right, at least the lengths of which they might have to go to try to sift through and ultimately become and be confident, right, in voting. We don't want anybody to be turned off. Sometimes people don't participate because they feel not only disconnected from the political process, but because they don't have enough information, right? And so they sit it out because they don't want to make a mistake. And we don't want people to feel even more confused or even less confident in terms of participating.
In the spirit of positivity, we have about a minute left. What have you seen in terms of successes of increasing voter turnout, especially among unlikely voters, in the last 60 seconds or so that we have?
Yeah, there is research that shows that we can see higher turnout, right? So when it comes to young people, particularly, but other historically underrepresented groups, any time that we kind of play the what I call the long game, kind of the deeper connect, deeper kind of outreach method. So you really need to make the case for voting. You connect with somebody early on in the election cycle, hopefully even before the election cycle begins. You talk about why it's important to vote. You come back and you revisit that. You connect it to issues that people care about, particularly young people. You want to make it peer-to-peer contact. Young people making the case to young people, and you help people kind of understand not only why the act of voting is important, like your civic duty, but also why it really makes a difference in their own lives and in their communities. And again, you do that over time and you kind of build that case. That kind of longer, deeper connection can make a difference. We do see turnout increase when those methods are used. And particularly for young people, anytime that we can support a young person, bring a young person right to the voting process, walk them through, because by definition, they're new and unfamiliar, it can make a difference in the life course. Voting is essentially habit forming for young people. We get them when they're young, at 18, 19, 20, so to speak, and familiarize them and make them comfortable and confident in the voting process.
Mindy and Kim, thank you so much for the time.
Thanks, Vicki. Great to see you.
Kim Alexander is the president of the California Voter Foundation, and Mindy Romero is the founder and the director of the Center for Inclusive Democracy. Up next, running for office can feel out of reach for a lot of political hopefuls, and often the candidate pool doesn't reflect the community at large. We're going to look at some programs here in Sacramento that are training the next generation of diverse public office holders. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Holding public office at any level of government, really, comes with a lot of responsibilities in the spirit of influencing policy. And although there have been strides, historically, candidates often don't reflect the makeup of the larger community. For many, taking the first steps to throw their hat in the ring can be intimidating, it can be time-consuming, and it can be costly. There isn't really a roadmap for this necessarily for everybody. However, in recent years, several programs have sprung up around Sacramento to help with that issue by providing training and skills with the goal to make future office holders more diverse. And some even have the opportunity to make history. CAP Radio Sacramento government reporter Kristen Lamb has been looking into these efforts and joins us with how these programs got started and the changes they hope to bring about. Hey, Kristen.
Good morning, Vicki.
So how did you learn about these training programs?
I first learned about them from a tip written by a reader of the Sacramento newsletter. Our colleague Claire Morgan, who writes the newsletter, sent me the tip, and the reader suggested CAP Radio look into the growing number of organizations and clubs that influence the rise of a more diverse pool of candidates or get out the vote. So I looked up programs and asked coworkers for suggestions. Our education reporter Srishti Prabha specifically recommended Nueva Epoca, a program we'll get into later.
When it comes to what they want to achieve, what they're looking for in terms of elected office, I mean, is anything too big or too small?
No, they're looking at public offices at all levels of government, local, state, and federal. Directors of the programs told me that it's important to have representation at all levels, from school boards and city councils to state lawmakers to members of Congress. And they're not just looking at elected public office. They're looking at appointed public offices, too, like state executive positions Governor Gavin Newsom selects people for.
And you also, I mean, you did quite a few interviews for your story to get really a front row seat to this. I mean, how would you describe, I guess, the overall energy and the drive of the people you spoke with?
Generally, the people running these programs are very passionate about the work. They seem to really believe in creating leadership pipelines so people from their underrepresented communities are prepared to influence civic policy decisions in the future. And for the participants, a lot of people in these programs are already leaders in their workplaces, but the programs can help people see themselves stepping up into public office, which, like you said, is a really big responsibility. One program participant I spoke with is Marissa Gutierrez-Green. Here she is explaining how a program called Nueva Epoca has changed her perspective.
when people tell me, oh, you just have this thing or you have this great energy, I can see you running for office, I just was kind of like, oh, that's nice and all. And I maybe considered it shortly. But now being in this program and really hearing the data around the Latino population being underrepresented, and yet we're the fastest growing minority group, and that really resonates with me as a leader in general to want to maybe step in and step up to that role and that opportunity for my community to see, you know, somebody of color in a position of power, especially a woman.
And just for some extra context, Asian Americans as well as Latinos are the fastest growing racial and ethnic groups nationally, according to the Brookings Institute, a nonprofit researching public policy.
Yeah, Marissa's talking about like going from a compliment, like something in theory, to actually putting it into practice and hopefully making it a reality. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the program Nueva Época. How and why was this organization founded? What do they want to accomplish?
It got started in 2021 after the COVID pandemic began. In Spanish, it means new era. The co-creator, Adrian Ruiz, told me that Latino communities in the Sacramento region have talked about building a leadership pipeline for decades. And he and others started this program to empower Latinos and prepare them to serve, whether that's in public office or on nonprofit boards. The goal is to make Sacramento leaders more closely reflect the area's Latino population.
And when it comes to the Latino population or Hispanics, according to the census, I mean, it's the largest demographic in the state. And in Sacramento, the population that identifies as Latino is almost like 40%, oh, almost a quarter, 25%. So how does that shake out when it comes to being reflected in politics and in elected officials?
Yeah, people I interviewed weren't able to help me find local data on representation in Sacramento area government, like for our school boards and city councils in the area. But other studies show disparities on a statewide level. A report by the Hispanias Organized for Political Equality found that Latinos hold 4%. 4% of county supervisor seats and 9% of city government seats, despite representing 20% of the state's total population. For appointed offices in California's executive branch, a UCLA study found Latinos have the largest representation gap among all racial and ethnic groups.
Okay, so then how is Nueva Época's training already shaping and impacting the political landscape in Sacramento? I mean, were there some notable participants so far?
Ruiz said that the program has helped get more than 70 people appointed to boards and commissions. Noel Mora, who won a seat on the Natomas Unified School Board in 2022, participated the same year. And those who have followed the City of Sacramento's Measure L Children's Fund might have heard of Monica Ruelas-Mares. She participated in Nueva Época last year and was appointed to the Measure L Planning and Oversight Commission recently. Yolo County Board of Education trustee Elizabeth Esquivel was part of the first group of fellows. She says the program showed her technical skills she needed to succeed, in addition to affirming that she belonged on the board. Here she is explaining how program mentors encouraged her.
There's no doubt about it that they said, no, we belong. We belong there. You need to be there. You need to speak up. You come from a single parent household. You come from a low income background. You're first generation. You need to have a voice to represent those students that are not always represented.
And there are other organizations that are really pushing in this effort as well. Another organization that you spoke with was the Stonewall Democrats of Greater Sacramento. This is a chapter of a larger nationwide caucus. How are they guiding hopeful office holders?
Stonewall Dems provides training to LGBTQ plus people who might be interested in serving in public office in the future. It also partners with state and national organizations to connect members with larger training opportunities. For example, it's collaborated on programs with groups like the LGBTQ plus Victory Fund, which works to elect queer and transgender people across the nation.
Hmm. What's been motivating the Stonewall Democrats in our area to deepen their political bench, especially when it comes to candidates with LGBTQ plus backgrounds?
I spoke with Stonewall Dems President Jonathan Cook about this. He says while there's been progress on LGBTQ plus issues, trans rights are especially at risk. He says the club wants to see LGBTQ people involved at any place where decisions are made, from school boards to the state legislature. Here's Cook explaining the importance of meaningful representation.
Especially at this moment where, trans rights and trans issues are under attack in so many places, even here in California, where, you know, there was a bill introduced in the assembly earlier this year to force educators and school districts to out trans and non-binary students to their parents or guardians if they want to use their given name or they want to use different pronouns than what would be assumed are their pronouns. And so really there's, you know, a big effort to take that not only from the bill that failed in the assembly, but there's been an effort to take that school district by school district.
And you've discussed some of those school district debates here on Insight, local school districts that have discussed a gender notification or forced outing policy include ones in Rockland, Roseville, Elk Grove, and El Dorado Hills.
One of the participants that you spoke with within the Stonewall Democrats is Evan Minton, and he's running for state assembly and could make history as the first out transgender lawmaker. Evan's also joined us on Insight before, not so much about politics, but rather his activism and his personal journey. What motivated Evan to run for office?
He told me that he wants to bring his experience as a transgender man, as well as a legislative staffer and policy advocate, to the State Assembly District 6 seat. Minton says he wants transgender communities to have a seat at the table and have a representative who knows what it's like, someone who has lived experience and can advocate for trans communities. Here's how he explains the issue of having a seat at the table.
But it's always been my experience that if you're not there at the table, then you're always going to be on the menu. Whether you're the first thing on the menu or the last thing, if you're not there representing your community, you're always going to be on the menu. And the trans community is under attack, even in a state as progressive as California. The fight has come here.
I want to move to another group that you spoke with, and this is the New Leaders Council Sacramento. Tell us a little bit more about them.
It's another one of those national programs with local chapters. It focuses on connecting and training the next generation of progressive leaders. They've been active in Sacramento for 12 years and have trained more than 200 fellows. The co-director, Michael Lemus, told me that the program is an investment in the area's young leaders. Some people who have gone through the program include Chinua Rhodes, a member of the Sacramento City Unified School Board. He's also the director of community engagement for Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg. A couple other people listed as alumni are Sacramento City Council member Katie Maples, chief of staff Ryan Brown, as well as Evan Minton, whom we were just talking about.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with CAP Radio Sacramento government reporter Kristen Lamb about a number of programs here in Sacramento that are training individuals from underrepresented communities for future positions in public office. Okay, so give us a front row seat if you join one of these organizations. What do these training sessions and the workshops, what do they look like?
They can include listening to speeches, doing role plays, filling out worksheets, and having like group conversations. At a Nueva Epoca training I went to, the training for the day looked like and worked like a class. A professor lectured on negotiation, took questions, fellows filled out a survey, and the survey told them what their communication style is.
All right, so there's resources, there's trainings, you know, all in the spirit of potentially holding public office. Are there other benefits that participants gain?
Definitely. The programs also provide a support network for our participants. They aim to help them build relationships with their peers who might share similar identities, values, or experiences. Fellows and program runners told me about how they lean on their peers and connections even after the training ends. Michael Lemus, the NLC co-director, says he considers group synergy when going over applications, too. Here's how he puts it.
we're looking at individuals, but we're also thinking about the makeup of the class. And again, we want folks that go through the experience to be able to, one, bond over the progressive cause, but two, be able to learn from each other. Because ultimately what we want is folks that are going to make an impact on their city. And again, through a progressive lens. And the more people that you get to know, of course, that can help you out with that, the better. So that's the whole point of the cohort system, too.
Yeah. Are these programs just aimed at younger generations, for example, like Gen Z, or are they available for just for people of all ages across the board?
For the new Leaders Council, a lot of fellows are millennials or Gen Zers right now, but the program tends to focus on people who are mid-career level and doesn't limit it to people who are younger than Gen X. One of the Nueva Epoca fellows I talked to mentioned how she's a bit older than most of the participants. We actually heard from her earlier on. But she said they're all learning from and supporting each other wherever they are on their leadership journeys, whether they're, you know, a parent with adult kids or a parent with like a 2-year-old sort of thing.
You know, having these organizations is great. That's one thing. But how did you learn, like even anecdotally when talking to participants, how did they even know that these organizations existed and get connected with them?
Yeah, like sometimes they told me like, oh, their boss told them about an opportunity, or I think someone was involved like in the local Hispanic Chamber of Commerce and like through there, like a her mentor on that like recommended, oh, hey, you know, there's this program. I think you would be a great fit sort of thing. Or, you know, like Stonewall Dems, I believe they share some of the training opportunities on Facebook and that sort of thing as well.
Hmm. Is there a cost to participate in these programs? Do you know?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, overall, I mean, you got to really canvas, you know, 3 different organizations and they're all, you know, they have the same intention, but you know, they're curating, you know, who they want to be participants, so they're a little bit different as well. Overall, what was your like your big takeaway, you know, after talking to all of these people?
Yeah, I think these programs really do try to make our democracy better reflect the region's diversity, so our political systems are more inclusive. You know, that whole seat of the table aspect. Personally, I also think it's really interesting to pull back the curtain on how these programs aim to build pipelines and benches. Because, I mean, I don't know about you, Vicky, but you see sometimes like just people talk about like, oh, yeah, we need to build a leadership pipeline. And, you know, it's like, OK, but how does that actually happen?
And what does that look like?
Yeah. Well, it turns out there's a lot of training involved. And earlier when you mentioned like, oh, like, are these programs free? I know that like Nueva Epoca, they specifically get like some funding from the McClatchy Foundation and that sort of thing. So I'm sure that must help on the financial side of things. You know, I think that also like as journalists too, you know, like I think that there are a lot of parallels in terms of like trying to build leaders and more diverse leaders. Yeah. I think, you know, in any industry, even if you're not someone who's looking to run for public office, you might find that some of this resonates with you because it did for me. You can read more about the programs and the digital story at capradio.org. And if you listen to the radio feature at the top, you can hear what one of the Nueva Epoca trainings sounded like. And spoiler alert, there was some laughter involved.
What? Training can be fun? That's a shocker. Kristen, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Kristen Lamb is Cap Radio's Sacramento government reporter. Still ahead, she is a Sacramento fourth grader by school day and a music sensation outside the classroom. We are going to meet Boss Tootie and learn how she embraces her roots and how her love for performance all began. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. A Sacramento father and daughter have teamed up in a creative way that is bringing a lot of joy to other people. Boss Tootie is a 10-year-old hip-hop princess, as she likes to call herself, and after watching her father, Renzi, record songs, she decided to join in on the studio and use her own voice and her own message. The fourth grader has created singles and music videos to entertain and inspire a young audience. And like many artists, she pulls from her own life. Boss Tootie is African-American and Hmong. Her latest single embraces her Hmong roots, and last summer she performed at Juneteenth celebrations in Sacramento. I sat down with Boss Tootie and her father, Renzi, about how this all began. I just want to welcome you both to Insight. Thank you for making the time.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us here.
Well, Boss Tootie, you're the reason why we were talking today. I want to get to your name first. Where did Boss Tootie come from? It's such a cool name.
Thank you. So when I was a little kid, I was really into music by that time, so I wanted to start my own. And I made my own name from a nickname my dad called me. And since I thought I was a boss so much, I decided I named myself Boss Tootie. And since my dad calls me Toot, I get that from that.
Yeah, Ren, I hear you laughing along. That is pretty much how the story went. Is that accurate?
That's very accurate. Very accurate.
You know, so Boss Tootie, when it comes to your talents and being a musical artist, a hip-hop artist, when did that start? When did you start getting interested in this? You're 10 years old. You're in fourth grade right now.
I think I started about 7 years old. When I first started singing or rapping, it was about, like, it was not when I was professional yet. It was when I was rapping on my dad's friend's songs and his songs. And when I became 8, I started posting my own professional songs.
What do you enjoy most about it?
I like doing it for the fun, making people happy, or inspiring them to become like me.
Yeah, I can see you make a lot of people happy. I mean, even before we started this conversation, you were so complimentary of people around you, myself included. You like making people feel good.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I do.
Well, where do you think that comes from? I would imagine your dad and another family members or friends probably have a lot to do with that.
I mostly get it from my grandma and my dad.
I love it. You know, Ren, when you started, you know, really discovering that your daughter had a talent, when did you kind of like the light bulb go off where you're like, hey, let's actually put her in front of a microphone?
You know what? She made it easy for me. She came to me. I think it was one afternoon I was actually recording. I don't know if I was in a session personally or somebody was there, but she said, Dad, when am I going to get the opportunity to tell my story? And I was like, your story? And she's like, my story. So she said, yeah, she wanted to record. And then I think it was weeks later or something like that. She came up with her own name. Like she explained, you know, her nickname has always been Tootie. So, but one day she just threw the boss in front of it. She came to me one morning and was like, Dad, I got a rap name. And I was like, really? What is it? And there, Boss Tootie was born.
Yeah, I would imagine it wasn't that much of a surprise for you, given you're a musical artist as well. And right. So she obviously had that foundation, you know, pretty much since birth.
Right.
If Boss Tootie, I mean, the fact that you're doing this with your dad, I love that. How is it working so closely with a parent?
I like working with my dad. I think we make a really good team, and I just love working with him because I love him so much.
All right, well, we're going to get to listening to some of your music. I think your latest single is Say It in Hmong.
Yeah.
Where does this come from? What inspired it?
It came from my mom because she inspired me by making a song about my culture, one of my cultures. And she's Hmong, and I'm half Hmong, so I decided I wanted to make a song about being Hmong.
And you did, so let's take a listen to it.
I'm about to say it in Hmong.
an Activity Productions exclusive.
I'm about to say it in mine.
I not only love this song, I love the music video that goes with it. What do you like more? Do you like them both equally, creating a music video or also creating a rap?
I prefer doing the music video. It's really fun. I like traveling. I like going around places and, you know, just doing my thing.
How was the process, you know, creating the song? It's a lot of work to create a rap.
Okay, so first things first, if y'all want to know, it does not take, like, one try to just do it. You have to do it over and over and over and over. You don't just do it one time and then done. You have to work, like, it may take a long time if it's, like, your first time, but when you do it more, then you do it more and more, you'll get better and better and better. So that's just the tip.
Yeah. And Ren, I also think, I mean, clearly, I think your daughter was exploding with talent ever since she was born and has a tremendous amount of confidence as well. But I also think this teaches like work ethic also by learning this, right?
It does. And that part I'm proud of because she's getting a cool grip on entrepreneurship as a young person and, you know, building her brand from the ground up. So, yeah. Definitely.
All right. So the next song we're going to listen to is Just Like Magic. Tell us about this song.
It's a song inspired by like anything and everything can be magical.
Yeah, I love that. All right. Let's take a listen.
Activity Productions exclusive.
Even have like a dance to it too. I love the choreography. I wish people could actually see it. What goes into creating the rap, the lyrics? I mean, obviously you got to practice a lot to get in front of a mic and do it and also do it in a music video as well. But what talk to us about the beginning process, working with your dad to make this come to life.
Well, me and my dad both work on it together. We're like a little team who like a band to work together to, you know, create music into the life and to turn it into life. Work together, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I get it. You know, all of it is important work. You know, Ren, this obviously isn't your first kind of collaboration. You have been in hip hop and been a musical artist for well before, you know, Boss Tootie was around. Mm-hmm. But what is it like doing it with your daughter, doing it with your child?
You know what? It's actually refreshing because, like, as an artist personally, I did a lot of what we would call street rap. So it was like night and day, but it gave me the opportunity to explore another creative side. And she articulates well. So she's a writer as well. She reads very well, writes very well. So I jump in a lot with the structure of the song a lot, but she'll pen a lot of her material, the ad lib. She's very creative. So she did have like a natural knack for it. So.
Oh, I mean, that's clear. That is so clear. Our last song is Jump. So tell us about Jump.
A Jump is a song. The Jump song is inspired by, you know, like making kids want to get off their feet and start dancing. Like a hyped up song to make kids just want to like boogie.
Yeah, boogie down. All right, let's take a listen.
Hey, yo, Boss Tootie, you ready to do your duty?
CMG, you already know if you stay ready, that means you don't have to get ready.
Why don't you step up and let the people know who you are?
Okay, bet.
Come on.
Boss Tootie, I would like to give you a brief introduction. I will turn off when I'm in the function. Me on any beat means go time. And if you're trying to compete, that means no shine. As a kid, I'm very sweet and I'm wonderful. When I rap, I'm unique and I run the show. It's T, double O-T-I-E. A boss, something like a VIP. And you can find me on your smart device. And the bars are way above market.
Boss Tootie, how does it feel to watch other people enjoy your music, to get up and dance to your music?
Well, I feel pride in myself. Truly, truly shocked, actually. I really like it when people enjoy my music. I have that tingly, happy feeling in my heart or something. Something good.
And that is something so special to feel, you know, a connection with other people because of something that you created. It wouldn't have existed if you didn't create it. That must feel so special.
And if I did not create any of my songs, I wouldn't be Boss Tootie. I would have just been a normal kid.
And who needs normal, you know? Right. None of us. None of us need normal. Well, a big part of this, I mean, you are the one that is in the very best way, like putting your daughter on the spotlight, you know, reaching out, making sure that people see, you know, everything that Boss Tootie is and can create and how happy you can make people. Mm-hmm. Where would you like to see this go?
You know, I would like this to create opportunities, like boundless opportunities for her. So whatever she wants to do in life. So if this opens the door for her, if she wants to act, if she wants to be a ghostwriter for a script on a movie, you know, I mean, whatever, you know, even if this opens the opportunity to a college professor saying, hey, I know who you are. Come on in. Or a doctorate program or whatever, you know, whatever it can turn into for her. This is what I want to create for her.
Finally, Bryn, given that you're a parent and, mm-hmm. you know, you really just created such a wonderful type of bond with your child by, you know, just really working together. What advice do you have for people who are parents or caretakers of children that, you know, really want to do this, maybe don't have the creative or musical background like yourself, but right. want to create that type of relationship and do something in tandem with their child?
You definitely have to be open to listening to your child. So that's the advice, because we were all children at one point, and you know, we wanted to be listened to as well. So, I had a fairly good childhood, but you know, I'm listening to my child and what she wants to do, and you know, and I kind of follow, you know, she kind of dictates what she really wants, and I kind of say, okay, let's see if we can make this happen. So it's me listening to her and creating opportunities.
And what advice do you have for kids like yourself? You know, if they're 10 years old, they want to do something like this, you know, but maybe they're a little scared or intimidated.
If you're scared to do this, just know, some people will put you down, but more people will love you than the people who don't. Just know that. And another tip, don't expect the song to easily be made, okay? And the music videos.
That is a great way to end it. Well, Boss Tootie and Renzi, thank you so much.
Appreciate you. Appreciate,
thank you.
Appreciate this opportunity.
Thank you for having me.
We loved having you.
Thank you.
And that is 10-year-old hip-hop princess Boss Tootie, along with her father, Renzi. We have a link to Boss Tootie's songs and her music videos on our Insight page. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. And if you want to talk with us, you can shoot us an email, insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Leshinsky and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer and audio engineer is Chris Feltz. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.